and from verse 16, 1 Kings chapter 18 and from verse 16. We're joining in the narrative of Elijah, the great prophet. So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. When he saw Elijah, he said to him, "Is that you, you troubler of Israel?" "I have not made trouble for Israel," Elijah replied, "but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned the Lord's commands and have followed the Baals. Now, summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel, and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." So Ahab sent word throughout all Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. Elijah went before the people and said, "How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him." But the people said nothing. Then Elijah said to them, "I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets. Get two bulls for us. Let Baal's prophets choose one for themselves, and let them cut it into pieces and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. I will prepare the other bull and put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. Then you call on the name of your God, and I will call on the name of the Lord. The God who answers by fire, he is God." Then all the people said, "What you say is good." Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, "Choose one of the bulls and prepare it first, since there are so many of you. Call on the name of your God, but do not light the fire." So they took the bull that was given to them and prepared it. Then they called on the name of Baal from morning till noon. "Baal, answer us," they shouted. But there was no response. No one answered. And they danced around the altar they had made. At noon, Elijah began to taunt them. "Shout louder," he said. "Surely he is a god. Perhaps he's deep in thought, or busy, or travelling. Maybe he's sleeping and must be awakened." So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears, as was their custom, until their blood flowed. Midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time for the evening sacrifice. But there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. Then Elijah said to all the people, "Come here to me." They came to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. Elijah took 12 stones, one for each of the tribes descended from Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, "Your name shall be Israel." With the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he dug a trench round it large enough to hold two seers of seed. He arranged the wood, cut the bull into pieces, and laid it on the wood. Then he said to them, "Fill four large jars with water and pour it on the offering and on the wood. Do it again," he said, and they did it again. "Do it a third time," he ordered, and they did it the third time. The water ran down around the altar and even filled the trench. At the time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, "Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again." Then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. When all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, "The Lord, he is God! The Lord, he is God!" Then Elijah commanded them, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Don't let anyone get away." They seized them, and Elijah had them brought down to the Kishon Valley and slaughtered there. And Elijah said to Ahab, "Go, eat and drink, for there is the sound of a heavy rain." So Ahab went off to eat and drink, but Elijah climbed to the top of Carmel, bent down to the ground and put his face between his knees. "Go and look toward the sea," he told his servant. And he went up and looked. "There's nothing there," he said. Seven times Elijah said, "Go back." The seventh time the servant reported, "A cloud as small as a man's hand is rising from the sea." So Elijah said, go and tell Ahab, hitch up your chariot and go down before the rain stops you. Meanwhile, the sky grew black with clouds, the wind rose, a heavy rainstorm came on, and Ahab rode off to Jezreel. The power of the Lord came on Elijah, and tucking his cloak into his belt, he ran ahead of Ahab all the way to Jezreel. Well, please keep that passage open as we come to look at it together. A friend of ours was recently out shopping for some new socks. She'd gone to Marks and Spencer, one of those really big out-of-town Marks and Spencers that you get. And the selection of socks that she found there was overwhelming. As she relayed it, apparently it was frankly too much. There were too many socks to choose from. She wavered, not sure where to start. What kind of colour did she want? What fabric? What style? What length to go for? In fact, having dithered and doubted for a little while, she decided that the best thing to do was to leave. Go home, have a cup of tea. Worry about socks another day. Maybe you've had that sort of experience yourself. You're off to the supermarket and you need, I don't know, some new toothpaste. You think, well, that's simple enough. Well, oh no. It's not simple, is it? Because the toothpaste options don't just cover a bit of a shelf or even just one shelf. They seem to virtually cover a whole section. If you go up to the Sainsbury's up there in Stanmore, and so if you're anything like me, you think, I don't know where to start here. What do I want to clean my teeth with? Something white? Something made of charcoal? All these different stripes? All these different varieties? It's absolutely bamboozling. You stand there dilly-dallying, paralysed by all the possibilities. Well, lots of people have exactly that kind of experience when it comes to God. There are so many options, so many opinions. It's hard to know what we ought to do. An agnostic, sorry for those of you for whom English is a newer language, it's a bit of an odd word, that agnostic, but an agnostic is someone who says, I just don't know when it comes to God. Or maybe even, we just can't know. Maybe there is a God, maybe there isn't. Maybe it's the God of the Bible. Father, Son, Jesus Christ, and Spirit. Or maybe it's Allah. Or maybe it's Vishnu. Or maybe it's the path of Buddhism. Who knows? It's so tricky. I had a very honest conversation with somebody here once who was from a Jewish background. And he said to me, I go to the synagogue and they tell me one thing. And then I come here and you tell me another. And I don't know what to think. Well, he is not alone in that. Lots and lots of people sit on the fence when it comes to God. In fact, maybe that feels like a sensible place to be. I mean, why not hedge your bets? Surely two gods are better than one. So why commit? Well, agnosticism, doubting and dithering, sitting on the fence and hedging our bets when it comes to God, that is not a 21st century phenomenon. That has happened for thousands of years. And it was happening in Israel in the days of Elijah. Long gone by now were the days of David and the early years of Solomon, in which the people knew that the Lord, that Yahweh, was their God. And so they put the worship of the Lord at the centre of their national life. No, now we've had years and years of expanded choice in the supermarket of gods. And King Ahab and his wife Jezebel, who are currently on the throne, they're currently in charge in Israel, in the northern kingdom, well, they have heartily endorsed shopping around. Golden calves, the Asherah, the Baal, maybe a sprinkling of Yahweh here and there, take your pick. That is Elijah's verdict for Ahab. There in verse 18 of chapter 18, he says, I have not made trouble for Israel. You and your father's family have. You've abandoned the Lord's commands and have followed the Baal. Now summon the people from all Israel to meet me at Mount Carmel. Bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. And we discover here in 1 Kings chapter 18 where that kind of approach has left the people. Verse 21, Elijah went before the people and said, "How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord, if Yahweh is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him." Wavering, doubting, unsure. God's people living in the land of God's promise don't know who they think the real, true, and living God is. And so God, in his grace, and with the help of his prophet Elijah, is going to show them. He's going to leave them in no doubt as to who the true God is. Because God is intent on bringing his wavering, wandering people back to him. And he's going to do it through an eye-opening showdown on Mount Carmel. Verse 22, then Elijah said to them, "I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets. Get two bulls for us. Let Baal's prophets choose one for themselves, let them cut it into pieces, put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. I'll prepare the other bull, put it on the wood, but not set fire to it. Then you call on the name of your God, I will call on the name of the Lord. The God who answers by fire, he is God." So the stage is set. Roll out the bunting. Set up the bleachers and the electronic scoreboard. We are going to have a contest. You can imagine the posters going up on the billboards and the adverts running on the side of buses, the pay-per-view trailers running constantly on the telly. A great crowd gathers to witness what looks on paper like an absolute mismatch. In fact, everything about the way it's set up is intended to give that impression. This is not a fair fight. Just picture the scene. On the one hand, we have the prophets of Baal. There are 450 of them. And ranked behind them are the 400 prophets of Asherah, almost 1,000 strong. And then on the other side, we have Elijah. Just Elijah. He says in verse 22 there that he is the only one left. The only one of the prophets of Yahweh. Now you might remember, if you were with us a few weeks ago, when we were last in 1 Kings together, that's not quite the whole story. Because there are another 100 prophets out there, but they are staying out there. They're in hiding under the threat of death. And so in any meaningful public sense, it is just Elijah. One against hundreds. How do you like those odds? And Elijah is playing away from home because the venue is Mount Carmel. And that is on Baal's home territory. Mount Carmel is actually up quite close to the modern-day city of Haifa, if you know your Israeli geography. We're not near Jerusalem, we're not near the temple. We're in a place where the altar of the Lord, we discover later, has been torn down. This is hostile territory. Now, over the last summer just gone, if you were here, you might have noticed that England did all right in a major football tournament. We reached the final of the Euros down there at Wembley. Feels like a long time ago now, doesn't it, really? But I'll make a confession to you as an English football supporter. There is always a bit of a nagging doubt amongst us that our best performances at World Cups and at European Championships and those kind of things, World Cup in 1966, Euro 96, Euro 2020, those are our best performances and they've all come here. It's one thing to succeed at home. It's another thing to do it on the road. And so if Yahweh were to triumph here at Carmel, well, that would be some statement. And then the conditions, well, they are perfect for fire. There's been a drought in Israel for the last 3 years. And so as they construct their bonfire atop the altar, the prophets of Baal must be thinking pretty good about things. A discarded cigarette butt would set the whole thing ablaze. We're not going to struggle for fire today, folks. In fact, that means that whoever goes first, well, they've got a massive advantage. It's like winning the toss at the start of a test match on a very flat wicket. Now, I know I've lost you, some of you, at that point, because that's a cricket reference. And for some of you, cricket is a very strange and confusing thing. But in cricket, the conditions make a massive difference. And because a test match is played over 5 days, the conditions change. And so they toss a coin to decide at the start who gets to decide if they bat first or if they bowl first. You get lots of analysis on the first day of a test match over what the pitch is like that they're going to play on. But that analysis here at Carmel, that would have been very straightforward. You can imagine the coverage. And now we're going over live to Mount Carmel, where our expert Gideon is waiting to give us an update on how things look. Good morning, Gideon. Morning, Seth. How's it looking up there? Well, I've got to say, mate, I've never seen an altar like it. The wood here is absolutely bone dry. It's like kindling. Absolutely ideal conditions for fire starting. Okay, that's interesting, Gideon. So you think the prophets will want to go out first today? Oh, without a shadow of a doubt. Whoever starts off here this morning has a huge advantage. But there's no toss-up to decide who goes first. Because Elijah just gives away the benefit of leading off. Verse 25, Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose one of the bulls and prepare it first, since there are so many of you. Call on the name of your God, but do not light the fire. And so it's all set up. And here they come, waving to the crowd. And they set about imploring Baal to send fire. Baal, answer us. Baal, answer us. Baal, answer us. All morning they keep going. Just imagine the noise. Baal, answer us. Baal, answer us. They called on the name of Baal from morning until noon. Baal, answer us, they shouted. But there was no response. No one answered. And they danced around the altar they had made. Elijah's got a suggestion for them in verse 27. Shout louder, he said. Surely he's a god. Perhaps he's deep in thought or busy. That's quite a polite translation. And by the way, there it says he's busy. Basically, it means probably Baal's gone to the loo. That's where he is. So you've got to shout a bit louder so that he hears you, so that he can actually realise he's got a job he's supposed to be doing. Baal, like any pagan god, is just described by Elijah like an uber person. And so Elijah says, well, you've obviously got to kind of rouse him. You've got to kind of get his attention. He's just not noticed you. You guys need to up your game a bit. If he's going to send fire, he must be distracted. And so they do. They shout louder. And they really up the ante on their religious fervour. They slash themselves with blades and spears in the hope that their blood will rouse Baal to action. Maybe that's what he wants. The noise, the dancing, the rending of flesh. They keep going all afternoon and on into the evening in this frenzy. Frantically shouting and slashing and dancing. Baal, answer us! Midday passed and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time for the evening sacrifice. But there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. It is a tragic summary. like people banging on the door of an empty house. There is nothing. And it doesn't matter how loud the banging or how desperate the cries, there is nobody home. And then Elijah steps forward. He calls the people to make sure that they can see, to make sure that they can hear what he's about to do, because it's for their benefit. He rebuilds the altar. 12 stones, one for each tribe. It's a visual symbol and a reminder to them. Remember who you are, Israel. Remember where you've come from. All 12. It wasn't always Israel in the north and Judah in the south. It was once just Israel, just God's people in the land God gave us. Don't forget who we are. Don't forget where we've come from. Don't forget everything that the Lord has done for us. And then, having built the altar, Elijah begins to dig a trench. Can you imagine the people? What is he doing? This is an unusual approach. Well, you can say that again, because Elijah then says, fill 4 large jars with water, pour it on the offering and on the wood. Do it again, he said. Do it a third time. 12 jars of water. The thing would have been absolutely soaked. It's the worst tactical approach to bonfire lighting that the world has ever seen. There's no question that it is going to take something absolutely out of this world if there is going to be a bull burning here tonight. If they had bookies there that day, then the odds on the scoreless and scorchless stalemate would have been coming right in as they tipped the water again and again. And then Elijah steps forward and prays. It is so beautifully understated, isn't it? No shouting, no dancing, no swords. The sacrifice is the only blood that needs to be shed. He just steps forward and prays. It's there in verses 36 and 37, if you want to have a look down. The time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. Let me read that prayer again, just so we hear it. The prayer is not for Elijah's benefit. It's not for God's benefit. God knows who he is. It is for the benefit of the people. Elijah preaches to them in this simple prayer. He declares God's identity, his relationship with them. He calls on God to demonstrate his power so that the people, doubting, confused, wondering, wavering, might be turned back. Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. And then, the fire comes down and the whole lot goes up in flames, all of it. Not just the sacrifice, not even just the flammable bits, the whole lot. Stones, soil, water, vaporized, evaporated. Remember the rules? Verse 24, they were very, very simple. The God who answers by fire, he is God. Well, the people remember the rules. And so there is absolutely no question about the outcome. Verse 39, when all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, the Lord, Yahweh, he is God, the Lord, he is God. It has been a contest, but not a fair fight. In fact, there's been no real competition. It's like an exhibition match. It's like one of those boxing bouts organised with a cupcake opponent so that the champion can simply demonstrate his prowess. In fact, truly, when we step back, we realise that there has been no contest at all here at Mount Carmel because there has been no genuine opponent. God doesn't defeat Baal at Mount Carmel because Baal was not there to be defeated. It's not about defeating an opponent for Yahweh, this. It's about demonstrating reality to the people. And those who were there on that day were to be in no doubt. Those reading the account of this day in exile were to be in no doubt. And we here today, we are to be in no doubt. There is no contest when it comes to God. He stands absolutely alone, unchallenged, undisputed. He is the champion, the Lord, the King, the Victor, the Almighty. There may be pretenders to the throne, but there is only one. The Lord. He is God. And that isn't just information to be known. It's reality to be acted upon. Remember how Elijah implored the people, if the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him. Friends, that I think is the implication of the passage for us today. The contest at Carmel is a call to follow the one and only true and living God, Yahweh, the God who made the world, who rules the world, who calls people to himself, who has demonstrated his power and love for that people, yes, here in the fire at Carmel, but even more so upon the cross at Calvary. As the fire came down here from heaven, so this passage ought to serve for us as a blazing searchlight upon our hearts, upon the ways in which we waver between the options. Because there may not be so many Baal worshippers around in Harrow these days, but for Baal and Asherah here, we could insert any other supposed God. The gods of other religions, the gods of materialist atheism, the gods of self-centered humanism, anything which might be before us and cause us to doubt and to waver, to hedge our bets, to drift away from following the Lord and the Lord alone. And it is so easy to do so. It seems like the people in Israel hadn't necessarily rejected Yahweh outright. Not for the most part, but you know, they just weren't sure. How could they know? Well, Elijah shows. I think we generally think of agnostics, people who kind of can't decide or don't want to decide or don't think they can decide. I think we generally think of agnostics quite fondly. And there is a refreshing humility and honesty to saying, I don't know, I'm not sure. But Elijah doesn't have much time for that approach. No, he says, if Yahweh is God, follow him. And maybe, like the people on that day, this is God's means of bringing you back. Turning your heart back to him. Maybe you know that you've dithered and doubted. Maybe for understandable reasons, when the alternatives are so numerous and so popular. But maybe today the record here in 1 Kings chapter 18 of what God did then is his very means of saying to you here and now, come back. Because there's nowhere else to go. All those other options are no option at all. All those other ways are dead ends. All those other doors are but locked entries to empty houses. empty, powerless, destined for humiliation and destruction. That's the end that befalls the prophets of Baal that day, there in verse 40. Elijah sees to it that they carry out the judicial penalty that was written in the law for those who deliberately and knowingly led God's people away from him. For those who led the people away from the Lord of life and toward death, death was the fitting and fair punishment. Because it is no small thing to turn away. All the way since 1 Kings chapter 11, since the downfall of Solomon, Israel has been, I think you could say, keeping an open mind, exploring other options, embracing a multicultural approach to religion and spirituality. I suspect that actually at this point in their history, the nation in some ways looked quite a lot like 21st century London. Lots of options. Some faithful followers of Yahweh, sure, some devout believers, but lots and lots of people just kind of dabbling here and there, just sitting on the fence. But the fence isn't a safe place to sit, and so the Lord sends Elijah to push them off. It really matters. And God, in his grace, demolishes the doubt. The Lord, he is God. And what a relief that is. It's like standing in the supermarket aisle and looking at this bewildering display. The options, the approaches, the spiritualities, the religious systems, and thinking, what am I supposed to do with all this? Do you know what? Maybe I'll just go home and have a cup of tea. And then, before your eyes, the shelving crumbles, the display is swept aside, and there remains, in glorious, unique isolation, just one. What a joy to have it made so clear, as on that day. And God has made himself clearer still in these days through Jesus, in Christ's sacrificial death, and then wonderfully, clearly, publicly in his resurrection. We have a display of unparalleled power. Unique. The Lord. He is God. And he doesn't just make himself clear, but here in 1 Kings 18, he shows himself to be excellent. Because the only God who is God is also the God who is good. We see that underlined here at the end of the chapter, when, having unequivocally displayed his lordship over Baal in sending the fire, Yahweh underlines it emphatically and mercifully in the sending of the rain. We've known since the very beginning of the chapter that that's what's happening. Verse 1 of chapter 18, after a long time, in the third year, the word of the Lord came to Elijah, go and present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the land. After 3 years of drought, rain is coming. But it had to be clear that it wasn't Baal, it wasn't the supposed storm god who is providing it. For God to be rightly exalted in the deluge, Baal must first have been thoroughly exposed. And so it now comes to pass. After 7 trips for Elijah's servant, go and look, go again, go again, go again, go again, go again, go again. In God's perfect timing, from the tiny beginning of a cloud the size of a hand, comes the downpour of God's blessing. Not earned, not deserved, but life granted in Israel. Because that is what the Lord is like. Ahab is even given the grace of a weather forecast so that he can beat the rain home in his chariot. Not that he can beat Elijah, as verse 46 tells us. God wins every event going in this chapter. But the falling rain follows the falling fire in testifying that Yahweh alone is God and that he is good. There is no other. Be in no doubt about him. Turn to him. Turn back to him. Follow him. Just take a moment and then I'm going to pray.